Thank you, Jeff, for leading the service up to this point. Oh, no, I don't actually. Okay. thank you also for Maggie for doing that children's talk. I didn't want to do it. Jeff didn't want to do it, so we dumped her into it. And that was a wonderful job involving children, even though the body collapsed at one point. But it came back together. So those who don't know me, those who are visiting, my name's Ken. I'm one of the members of the church. The normal minister, he's away in France with his family, so we wish them really well. Especially if you're visiting us, a very warm welcome to you. A couple of weeks ago, I was on holiday in Devon, and we visited this very small church called Croy Baptist Church. It was a church with members of perhaps no more than 30. The numbers swelled a little bit during the summer months, as you can imagine, but every after Sunday service, they have Sunday lunch. And they said, you must stay, you must stay. And of course, it's a small church, and there were seven of us. So that's us plus Ali. It's not as if I had a secret child or anything. It was Ali there also with me. Seven of us joining this small group. We thought, ooh, maybe not. But they were so welcoming. There was enough food. They had hidden things that came out. And so we loved it so much, we went back for more the following Sunday. We can't promise you lunch today. However, there will be coffee and tea through there. So you're most welcome to go through. And talking about coffee, young people, you are on the coffee duty. I can see two young people there. If any of you could actually help with them, my children, Megan and Tommy, then please help them. Tommy looked very nervous. How do I make coffee? So... one more thing, Helen Morris. Yes, Helen Morris, as you know, is the daughter of David Morris, who was the minister here for 10 years before Jim arrived. This is her last Sunday in Cambridge, sadly. She has been here doing her PhD at Tyndale House. Now she has a teaching position at Mornings, starting September. So it's a wonderful news, but I'm afraid she will be leaving Cambridge. This is her last Sunday, so we just want to give you and everything you've done. She was very involved with the Sunday evening services and sometimes preached as well. And we will miss you, but I'm sure you'll do great things teaching others. So good luck with that. Now, those of you who have been in church for a few years would know that I had... an opportunity to be in a Hollywood film starring Keanu Reeves. And, I'm waiting. The picture hasn't arrived. Aha. There's me sitting with Keanu Reeves in a film called 47 Ronin. It is a story, that's me on the left. I know it's a funny hairstyle. I had to shave. They paid me £15 to shave my hair. I didn't have any speaking part. But it is a famous Japanese story of a samurais, 47 samurais from the 1700s. And ever since that film, I enjoyed it so much, I have been wondering about a story that I could perhaps suggest, another Japanese story that I could suggest to a producer to produce. And the one book that keeps coming up to my mind is a very emotional, very strong, powerful story called Silence. It is written by a man called Shusaku Endo, and it's about Christians being persecuted in Japan around 1600. So in preparation for this sermon, I read the book while I was on holiday. My kids were shocked. Dad is reading a book. I usually read The Economist or The Financial Times and not a book, so it was good to be away doing that. And I googled, and it turns out that they are actually making a film about the book Silence, starring Liam Neeson. They chose him instead of me. And it's produced by Martin Scorsese, who interestingly did that film The Last Temptation of Christ in 1988. And you may have remembered that if you're my age, it's a very controversial film about Jesus. And the film is coming out next year, so we'll wait and see how close he sticks to the story. Now, Shusaku Endo, the writer, was born in 1923. He was baptized as a Catholic, very unusually, in Japan, at the age of 12. And after the war, he traveled to France to study. where he suffered from residual anti-Japanese racism. It was that time, just after the war, even from fellow Christians. He became depressed. He contracted tuberculosis, spent many months in hospital, had a lung removed, and underwent a crisis of faith. So before returning to Japan, he traveled to Palestine to research the life of Jesus, and this trip really transformed him. He came to the idea that Christ too had a non-rejection, and on his return to Japan, he used these experiences in his writing, and the book was written in 1966, based on the true characters in 1643. So just before I go on, the basic background about Japanese history, the Christianity arrived in Japan in 1549, where a Portuguese ship arrived with Father Francis Xavier, yes, who was one of the co-founders of the Jesuit orders. Now, you may not know what Jesuit orders is. You're not Catholic, so I don't blame you. They're a group of male Catholic people. And the current Pope is the first Jesuit Pope, actually, they've ever had. So he was one of the founders of them. He arrived in Japan, and the word spread. For the next 60 years, many Japanese people were converted to Christianity, and it is estimated that up to 300,000 Japanese became believers. Unfortunately, the word got to the shoguns, the samurai lords, and they didn't like it. So they started persecuting them. They started issuing eviction orders. And between 1640 and 1640, up to about 5,000 to 6,000 Japanese were killed. And they were tortured. They realized that by killing them, it's giving them the status of being a martyr. So they decided that maybe torturing them and asking them to apostatize is a better way of doing it. One way they did it was to strip them naked and pour boiled water on them until they repented. Or they tied them on wooden stakes and put them in the sea and let the seawater come and go and come and go for days and until they died. So it was a horrible way of punishing these Japanese Christians. And the way that you'll be released is to stand on one of these pictures of Jesus called Fumien. It's a wooden plaque with a copper picture of Jesus on it. And once you stand on it, then you're let off and you are officially have apostatized and no longer a believer in Jesus. So the story is about a Portuguese Jesuit priest called Father Rodriguez, who in 1640s set sail for Japan, determined to help the brutally oppressed Japanese Christians, and also to discover the truth about his former mentor, Father Ferreira, who had traveled to Japan decades before. And there was a rumor going around that he has apostatized in Japan. After a very long and treacherous journey, you can just imagine a sea journey from Portugal down to India, down to Macau, and up to Japan in 1640s. It was a very, very dangerous journey, lasting months. And they finally get there. Rodriguez and Garpe finally arrive secret in Japan and find a small, very small community of underground Christians. And they're hidden in a very basic wooden hut in a mountain hidden by these very poor and desperate Japanese villagers. There they spend many months in a very basic conditions, but they're able to minister to these villagers, hearing their confessions, serving communion, and baptizing babies. And they think after a month, few months, they start beginning quite confident that they're there because God had told them to be there. But of course, after a few months, they feel the risk. They have to run away from the village. They go their separate ways. All the while, there is this one character in the story, a really weasel-like character that they first meet back in Macau, who takes them to Japan, called Kichijiro. Now, my name is Kenjiro, so the name is fairly similar. That's where the similarity ends, thankfully. Jiro means second son, so I'm a second son. Kichijiro probably was a second son. He is dirty, he's rude, he's always drunk. But it turns out that he also was a Christian who was so weak that he stepped on one of these fumie at some point and escaped to Macau. And there, eventually, Rodriguez is caught whilst running away, betrayed by this Kichijiro character. Kichijiro is awarded a few silver coins for giving him up, just like Judas. They pursue a long process with a local governor called Inoue, slowly but surely chips away at Rodriguez's faith and tries to get him to apostatize by asking him to step on one of these familiar pictures. Now, there are two main thoughts that keep coming back to Rodriguez, which is what I want to focus first. First is the betrayal of this weasel-like man called Kichijiro. And this is actually a picture from the film, upcoming film, who obviously reminds Rodriguez of Judas. And in particular, Jesus' words that said, "What you're about to do, do quickly." Rodriguez says this: "These were words that from old he had never understood when he read the Bible. And not only these words, but the whole role of Judas in that man's life was something he had never been able to grasp. Why had that man, Jesus, included among his disciples the man who would eventually betray him? Even though he knew the real intention of Judas, why had he made as if he knew nothing for such a long time? Wasn't Judas no more than a puppet made use of for that man's crucifixion? And yet, if that man was love itself, if Jesus was love itself, why had he rejected Judas in the end? Judas had hanged himself at the field of blood. Had he been cast aside to sink down into eternal darkness?" This thought came back to Rodriguez again and again, not only as he was betrayed by someone, but also because he himself was repeatedly attempted or asked to betray God. So let's look at Judas. Other than his apostleship and his betrayal and his death, the way he died, little else is actually written about Judas in the gospel. He's always the last one on the list, but you can understand that when the gospel writers wrote that they put him at the end of the list of 12. The only detail about him that we know is that he was their treasurer. Now, not all treasures are bad or will betray you, I hasten to add. If you're a visitor, I am the treasurer of the church. But he seemed to have that talent of money. And we know this because we know that John says that he was the keeper of the money bag. In the scene where Mary anoints Jesus with very expensive perfume, which Jim preached on last week. Judas disowns Jesus' whereabouts with 30 pieces of silver, and he betrays him with a kiss. Why 30 pieces of silver? Well, there's a passage in Zechariah, which actually said in chapter 11, where Zechariah says, "I told them," the flock that he was managing, "if you think it's best, give me my pay, but if not, keep it." So they paid me 30 pieces of silver, and the Lord said to me, "Throw it to the potter, the handsome price at which they valued me." So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw them to the potter at the house of the Lord. So there seemed to be Judas' role being prophesied in the Old Testament already. But it's actually easy to forget that Judas actually played an active part in Jesus' ministry alongside the other 11. For it says in Mark chapter 8, sorry, that's a bit small, "Calling the 12 to him, he began to send them out two by two and gave them authority over impure spirits." Two by two. There was an unfortunate apostle who went with Judas as one of the two to minister. But it only makes me think that perhaps Judas at that time was actually doing what Jesus wanted him to do. He was doing the role that he was meant to as an apostle. And indeed, they went out and preached that people should repent. They drove out many demons and anointed many sick people with oil and healed them. So I can only think that Judas was also involved positively in Jesus' ministry. So why did Judas betray Jesus? Is it for the money? 30 silver coin? Maybe, but we think there must be a bit more than just money. Is it because Satan tempted him? Well, we know that Luke and John, both Luke and John, they say so Satan enters into Judas, causing him to offer betrayal, to do the betrayal. So maybe he was tempted.
But the big question is this: was he really assigned that role from the beginning to betray Jesus? That's a difficult one. Was he really born for that role? If Judas didn't exist, if Judas wasn't born, did the whole story would have happened? Somebody had to betray him. For we know in John chapter 6, it says, "For Jesus had known for them from the beginning which of them did not believe and who would betray him." Jesus knew it was going to be Judas. Matthew chapter 26 says, it quotes Jesus saying that, "Woe to that man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born." It's a difficult question that I don't have an answer to. And many theologians over centuries have wondered and argued. Here's a list of a few. Bertrand Russell thought that if Jesus foresees Judas' betrayal, then the betrayal is not an act of free will. So therefore, maybe he shouldn't have been punished. We don't know. Erasmus, a Dutch theologian, 14th century, believed that Judas was free to change his intention. But if he had changed his intention, what would have happened? We don't know. Martin Luther, at the same time, around the same time, countered this argument and said maybe Jesus' will, his will was unable to be changed. John Calvin states that Jesus was predestined to damnation. They don't agree on this. They don't know what the truth is behind Judas' role. It's difficult. However, we know that Judas was not the only one who betrayed. Perhaps in a not a big way, but Peter also betrayed Jesus. Peter was warned. Judas wasn't. Jesus said, "You will betray me tonight," before the cock crows 3 times. Do you know what Peter said? "Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you." What did Peter do? He betrayed him. What happened? The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. Then Peter remembered the word the Lord had spoken to him, and he went outside and wept bitterly. Very powerful picture. And yet, in Peter's case, Jesus forgives him. He says to him 3 times, "Feed my sheep." So that makes me think that maybe there is hope. Maybe God does not give up on you. That God does not give up on anyone. Maybe God did not give up on Judas. I don't know. My wife Eileen had a brother called Alan. He was 6 years older than Eileen, which would make him... Oh no, I better not say that, because then you'll be able to work out. Anyway, he was into punk music and rebellious. There's nothing wrong with being punk music. Look at Jeff, he's doing all right. But he was rebellious, he believed in all sorts of things, and when Eileen became Christian when she was 17, he was very critical. Every time he meets her, he would question her faith, and he questioned these difficult questions, and he said, "Why?" And when their father died, he asked this question, "Why did this happen, even though if you believe in God?" And so on and so forth. In 1994, on the 22nd of December, he eventually made himself become a civil engineer and was working away in Wales, away from his family in Kent. And they had finished their job for Christmas that year, so that was the last day of work, so they all went out for a drink, 22nd of December. He was walking home in a very dark Welsh road in the fog, was hit by a car and was killed. His wife, Donna, was advised not to see him because of the state of his body. And on the 23rd of December, we get this phone call from Donna saying, "We can't get hold of your mother," to Eileen. Eileen's mother and stepfather was just driving down from Scotland. excitedly as looking forward to Christmas, and we had to tell them when they arrived. When the police went to his caravan, on his table was a Bible open. We don't know what happened to Alan. We don't know whether we'll see him in heaven. But we have this hope that God never gives up on you. That even to that last moment, God may give you that chance. We don't know what's happened to Judas. What you're about to do, do quickly. Even if we don't fully understand the reason for Judas' role, and there are rightly plenty that we just don't understand about what God does, and this is one of those. If it is that God loves all and will not give up on anyone until the end, then however badly we let down God, like Judas did, maybe there is still hope for redemption. Kichijiro in the story betrayed Father Rodriguez, but there was a betrayer far worse in the Bible. And I wonder, and I just wonder, maybe here what is not said is more important than what is said. That Jesus on his return does not say anything about Judas. And we know he repents, Judas repents, for he tries to give the money back. So if there is even a sliver of hope for Judas, there is certainly hope for us. The second thought that comes back to Rodriguez again and again in the story is God's silence, and that's what the book is titled. Rodriguez is in a tiny prison, stinky with urine and full of bugs, and through the bars on the window of the cell, he watches an old and frail Japanese man getting beheaded in the courtyard. And he says to himself, so it has come to this. And as he clutches at the bars, he says this to himself. What he could not understand was the stillness of the courtyard, the voice of the cicada, the insect that makes the noise, the whirling of wings of the flies. A man had died. Yet the outside world went on as if nothing had happened. Could anything be more crazy? Was this martyrdom? Why are you silent? Here, this one-eyed man has died, and for you, you ought to know. Why does this stillness continue? This noonday stillness, the sound of the flies, this crazy thing, this cruel business, and you avert your face as though indifferent. This, I cannot bear. A while later, he is forced to witness the death of three more Japanese Christians. They were thrown into sea from a boat, wrapped in a straw mattress so that they could not escape, because his companion, remember there was another guy, Father Agape, because he would not apostatize. In desperation, Agape himself swims after them and drowns and dies. And Rodriguez says to himself, this sea stretches out endlessly, sadly, and all this time, over the sea, God simply maintained his unrelenting silence. His solitary confinement continues. And in his prison, he keeps hearing this sound of what he thinks is someone snoring. He assumes that it's the guard sleeping. He's eventually told that actually they're not the sound of snoring, but they are the sound of Japanese Christians groaning, their hands tied and hung upside down in a pit, with small incisions made behind their ears so that they don't die immediately. The blood would drip, drip, drip through the incision and through their nose and through their mouth. And at that point, at the lowest point, Rodriguez is then brought to meet Father Ferreira, the man he went in search, his mentor from years ago, decades ago. And Father Ferreira says that these three Japanese will be saved if you step on that fumie. Rodriguez screams in his head, stop! Stop, Lord! It is now that you should break the silence. You must not remain silent. prove that you are justice, that you are goodness, that you are love. You must say something to show the world that you are the August One. Why is God continually silent while those groaning voices go on? I don't know about you, but I often do think that life would be much simpler if God spoke. If God said something to you, if something appeared, a miraculous signs appear before you, then life may be a lot simpler. That you don't have this doubt, you can prove to everybody that God is there. Of course, God does speak in the Bible. How does he do it? Well, he speaks through visions. Abraham had a vision and heard the Lord say to him, and so on, in Genesis 15. God speaks through angels. In Genesis chapter 16, the angel of the Lord met Hagar at a spring in the desert on the road to Shur, and so on. Angels keep appearing. God speaks through dreams. In Genesis 28, this is a Jacob's ladder story. He dreamt that he saw a stairway reaching from earth to heaven, with angels going up and coming down on it, and there was the Lord standing beside him. "I am the Lord of the God of Abraham and Isaac," he said. God speaks through miraculous signs. Exodus is full of miraculous signs that God does. God speaks in a gentle whisper. 1 Kings 19, after the earthquake there was fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire there was the soft whisper of a voice. And of course, God sometimes speaks dramatically in the conversion of Paul from Saul. Suddenly a light from the sky flashed around him. He fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to him, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" So God speaks. We read it in the Bible. So why does not God speak to us like that? But actually, did he really speak to everybody in the Old Testament times like that? Possibly not. We do read the stories of God speaking to the special people at the special occasions. But in our everyday lives, maybe God didn't speak to them like that all the time. We do know that from the end of the New Testament to the beginning of, end of Old Testament to the beginning of New Testament, for 400 years, people didn't hear from God and they did wander. And suddenly the story of Jesus begins. And it's not just us who suffered from this. A year ago, almost, I preached, and thank you for letting me preach once a year, every year. This is the fourth year now that I'm doing this. And last year, I talked about John the Baptist. And the John the Baptist says in Luke chapter 7, calling two of them, he sent them to the Lord to ask, to Jesus to ask, "Are you the one who is to come, or should we expect someone else?" John the Baptist, as I said last year, was stuck in the prison for 2 years. He knew that Jesus was in there. The difficult point is that John the Baptist knew that Jesus knew that he was in there. And John the Baptist knew that Jesus knew that John the Baptist was a special person because of the way he was born, because of the way he was there in the baptism of Jesus and all sorts of things. And so John the Baptist, for a very serious reason, has been imprisoned because he criticizes Pilate, the king, for marrying a brother's wife. And he's stuck in a prison. And he's thinking, why isn't Jesus coming to save me? I'm praying every day. Why this silence? Jesus knows I'm here. Why isn't he coming to get me out of this place? Did God answer his prayer? No. He gets beheaded. Why did he get beheaded? Because Pilate's daughter did a dance. And they liked her dance, and her mother asked for the head of John the Baptist. How stupid is that? John the Baptist sat there and shouted at God, "Why this silence?" Was God silent? No, he wasn't silent. Where was Jesus? He was out there. Jesus says, "Go back and report to John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is proclaimed to the poor." Does the silence prove that God is not there? No. God is there working. John was kept in silence. Jesus also felt the silence of God. In the passage that Jeff read for us, it was 9 a.m. when they crucified him. At noon, Darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. And at 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And in the end, when Jesus had cried out once again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. Of course, Rodrigue does remember this scene and says this: "It is 3 o'clock on that Friday, and from the cross, this voice rings out to a sky covered with darkness." The priest had always thought, Rodrigue had always thought, that these words were that man's prayer, not that they issued from terror at the silence of God. Jesus experienced the silence of God. He had to experience the silence of God. He had to be at a position as far away as possible from God for that redemption to be meaningful. So is God really silent? Through his experience, Rodriguez says this to himself. He, Rodriguez, loved him, God, now, in a different way from before. Everything that had taken place until now had been necessary to bring him to this love. Our Lord was not silent. Even if he had been silent, my life until this day would have spoken of him. Now, and this is the point. John the Baptist felt silence and doubted. And yet his experience, his story, speaks to us today. So God wasn't silent. He was speaking because he speaks to us through that silence to John the Baptist. Jesus suffered God's ultimate silence. And we know that that is an absolute foundation of our faith. He had to experience the silence. But God spoke through that silence to us. He's still speaking to us today through that silence. So God is not silent. He is speaking through their lives, your lives, our lives. So in summary, what you're about to do, do quickly. Many great theologians cannot agree on Judas's role. But we're not told that he was condemned, that he was predestined to be condemned. So we hope that God gives chance to all of us that to the last second. So we have hope through Judas' story. My God, why have you forsaken me? God remained silent to Jesus, but God was speaking to us through that silence. So please don't be discouraged when you feel far from God. He is still speaking. We have faith. So I'd like to finish with a little verse from Joel 2 that says, "Come back to the Lord your God. He is kind and full of mercy. He is patient and keeps his promise. He is always ready to forgive and not punish. We have love." Did Father Rodriguez stand on the fumier? Well, you just have to wait for the film to come out.